maybe the strangest stranger of them all, in my humble opinion. His name is Samson. Samson. But before we dive into Samson's life, I want to ask you a question just to get you thinking for a moment. Have you ever looked back at your life to see the impact that you've had, good and bad, on those around you? Family, friends, coworkers, neighbors. You look back at the high points and the low points, and maybe the impact has been financial, emotional, relational, but we all have an impact on someone. What about spiritual? Have you ever looked back at the spiritual impact you've had on those around you on this world? And as you think back to those moments in your life, as some of you are having just film clips, if you will, in your mind are just flashing of great moments where maybe God used you to do something for him, and God used you to lead someone to the Lord, or God used you to have a difficult conversation with one of your children about God and it pushed them through the next step. Have you ever noticed that more often than not, the biggest moments of spiritual impact in our lives were found in moments of our greatest weakness, and moments immediately following maybe our greatest failures? The moments where we thought something was going to happen and it didn't, and yet out of that moment something great did happen for God? Or maybe it's even your greatest impact has happened on the other end of the worst thing that's ever happened to you. To you, not by you. It's amazing how our God loves to use our weakness to show his strength, doesn't he? Has anyone else felt that before? And the New Testament is covered with verses about it. When I am weak, he is strong. Paul talks about it constantly, about everything that he had in his life before Christ. After he gave his life to Jesus, he viewed it all as nothing. In fact, he was the one who even penned those words, "When I am weak, then I am strong." About how God used him in his darkest, most desperate hours in a more powerful way than in the moments where he thought things were going so well. Remember when he finally made it to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 22 and 23? His whole ministry was aiming to get back to Jerusalem to stand with his fellow friends and brothers in the Sanhedrin and finally deliver the big gospel presentation that he knew the Messiah. He was following him, and when he gets there, in this moment that he was going to have the greatest spiritual impact potentially of his entire career in life, what happens? He gets one sentence out and he gets punched in the mouth, and such a fight broke out that he was almost torn to pieces. In the moment where he thought he was going to have his greatest impact, I mean, what better audience? He had an inside invitation to stand in front of the Sanhedrin and preach the gospel, and he almost got torn apart. And then he finds himself in prison. After that, alone, bloodied, bruised, and Jesus comes to him and says, "Take courage, for as you were my witness in Jerusalem, you will be going to Rome." And then he gets to Rome, and he has a huge impact for God there, in his weakness, in his chains, in prison. That's the God we serve, right? We saw it in the Gideon story. God was not happy with the army he had assembled until it was stripped down to 300. Because God doesn't want anyone else to take glory from the field. So it seems like the stronger our human strength is, the more God is going to strip that so that we can truly be used by him in our deep and great weakness. So Samson. What is the first thing that comes to mind when I say the name Samson? Strength? Anything else? I just got a haircut this week, so pretty appropriate. And I just cut, very nice beard. Yes, he's taking the Nazirite vow on his beard here. When's the last time you got it cut, Steve?
Last year.
Last year? Full calendar year? Like 2012? Okay, very nice. I had an uncle once, a great uncle, who his beard was so long that he tucked it into the top of his shirt, and you just didn't know where it stopped. And I asked him when the last time he cut it, and this was a few years ago. He said 1969. So, bro, you got a ways to go, my friend.
I can feel
Now, it made my great uncle look a lot like a garden gnome, I will be honest. Didn't help that he wore a red pointy hat sometimes. I don't know why he did that, but Samson. So Samson, we're in Judges chapter 13, if you want to dive in there with me. And this is a very unique story because a lot of times in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles and Judges and Joshua, they tell history by in the third year of this guy's reign, Israel did great evil in the eyes of the Lord. And so God allowed this people group to oppress them. That's kind of how a lot of the chapters seem to start if you read through the Old Testament. It's some, the people are doing great, they turn their backs on God, they start serving another idol, and then God brings in an oppressor to bring them back to him, and then they cry out for deliverance. But sometimes they don't cry out for deliverance. Sometimes they get so used to the oppressor that they actually get Stockholm Syndrome, as we call it now. Where the captive actually sides with the captor. This may be what happened here, because we don't have any evidence in the first part of Judges chapter 13 that the people cried out for deliverance from the Philistines. It just says they're being oppressed, they're being ruled by them, and God decides to send them someone to pick a fight. Look at Judges chapter 13 and verse 1. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. Is this story starting to feel a little familiar in the Old Testament? Deliverer comes from miraculous beginnings. Okay, verse 3. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." You notice what it says there? It doesn't say he's going to deliver them. It says he's going to begin the deliverance. He's going to begin to save Israel. This is the guy that God's going to use to stir things up. Now, when it talks about being careful not to drink and no razor, and it's referencing the Nazarite vow, the Nazarite vow is enumerated in the book of Numbers, and it talks about three things being true of someone who takes a Nazarite vow. No razor shall touch any part of their head. They shall not touch anything to do with a grape, even not just wine, but a grape. So no raisins, no grape juice, nothing like that. And the third part is they cannot have any contact with anything dead. No carcasses at all. They can't touch it. They can't be involved. Even at a funeral or anything, they cannot be involved in anything to do with something that is dead. So no haircuts, no carcasses, and no grapes at all. But the Nazarite vow was very rarely, in fact, there's only a couple instances in the Bible where the Nazarite vow is done involuntarily, where Samson was born into this. It says from the womb, which means that his mother actually had to observe the Nazarite vow while she was pregnant even. So his vow started before he was even born. So he's born into this vow. He did not choose it, but normally in the book of Numbers, it was an outward sign of inward zealous devotion to God. So it was saying, for 40 days, I'm going to not drink anything, or for the next year, or for the next 5 years, or whatever it is, you take that vow as an outward sign of your inward devotion and passion for God. But it was usually short term, not the entire life. Now, it's interesting because in the New Testament, we have someone who was born under similar circumstances who was also taking a similar vow. Remember John the Baptist. And so here you've got Samson being born into this, and it says that he is going to begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. He's going to begin. So, begin his deliverance. And basically what this means, this word for begin here, is also used again at the end of chapter 13 to describe what God began to do in Samson. Look at the end of the chapter. We're going to be skipping around a little bit only because it's four chapters of content, and if I just read every verse, we'd be here till 1 o'clock p.m. And they put up another clock for me here, so I think I'm starting to get the hint. We got digital, we got analog, we're going to get a world clock, and pretty soon we're going to have flagmen with flashlights waving. No, that's good. So at the end of chapter 13, it says, "And the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the young man grew, and the Lord blessed him." That word for blessed there also means strengthened him. "And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Mahanadan between Zorah and Eshtaol." And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. Began to stir him. Now, what's interesting is we think of beginning as like just started, you know, like, well, God started to stir him up, stir. We even think of stir as a good word. Like, I was feeling a little stirred up last night, so, you know, I went to the game and I painted my face and I cheered loudly, or, you know, we're like, you know, I'm stirred up, you know, what can I say? It's like, it's the idea of like being maybe passionate or just like moved to some emotional response. But it's interesting because it says the Spirit of the Lord began here. The word for begin is a very violent term in this passage in Hebrew. In fact, it even refers to, you know, when you're trying to create a wedge into something, like maybe you're trying to crack a wall or something like that, and you're hitting and you're hitting, and finally there's a breach, the first crack in the wall happens. That's the word for begin here. Is that he's starting to create a wedge. He's starting to crack something in him. So as he's strengthening him, he's stirring him up. He's beginning to create a wedge and stir him up, which means to stir him up here means to thrust him into or use him as a hammer. So even God, as he's strengthening Samson and making him into the Incredible Hulk of the Old Testament, he is just crafting this violence in him and this breach in his own heart and this stirring that God does in him. So, the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. Okay, let's keep going. So here is incident number one. I think in order to understand the Samson and Delilah story, you have to understand the Philistine backstory with Samson. So we're going to spend a little time explaining just why everything with Delilah went so bad so quickly. Judges 14. Verse 1, "Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, 'I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife.'" Now hopefully verse 3 doesn't happen very much anymore, because it says, "But his father and mother said to him, 'Is no one in your family good enough for you to marry?'" Different time, different season. Different geographical location even. "But his father, 'Is there no one among our people that's good enough for you, that you must go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?' But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes.'" Remember how many times in the Old Testament says people were doing what was right in their own eyes? That means they were willfully disobeying what they knew God had commanded them to do. They were doing what was right in their eyes, not taking into account God's eyes. Okay. He sounds a little bratty too, doesn't he? Dad's like, "No." He's like, "Do it, Dad. Now." I mean, his poor dad in chapter 13, he's like, "How are we supposed to raise him? Like, what are we supposed to do?" It seems like that question was never fully answered here, right? I mean, if his dad's just like, "Okay, well, all we really know is don't let you drink or touch the grapes and don't cut your hair and do not let you touch anything dead. Outside of that, we have no parental control that we're going to be able to assert on you." Because you see over and over, he's a disobedient, defiant, prideful young man. The parents said to him strictly, "Do not do this." He says, "Will you just get me one, okay, Dad? Get her for me, for she's right in my eyes." Verse 4, "His father and mother did not know that this was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines." At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Verse 5, "Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah." Now, the vineyards of Timnah, let's just stop there for a second, world-renowned for the greatest vineyards in the world at this time, just unbelievable source of wine, of grapes, and things like that, so just very well world-renowned for this, but remember his Nazirite vow. And behold, verse 5, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon Samson, and although he had nothing in his hand, meaning no weapons, he tore the lion in pieces and was as one tears a young goat. Now, if you're wondering how one, I mean, it's like here, it's like, well, of course, like you tear a young goat. I don't know how many of us have torn young goats here. That was an elective at school. I didn't take that class. But I guess what I studied out was this kind of like a wishbone move, except it's not a bone. It's actually a living thing. And you grab the back two legs and tear apart. It's not a good way to go, no matter what we're talking about. So he tore it in half, tore it to pieces. But it's interesting here because it says, but look at the end of the verse, but he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Now, wasn't that a little bit confusing? I thought they were walking with him. So at some point, he just kind of took his own path here. Maybe when he got close to the vineyards. Maybe he's like, hey, Mom and Dad, I just need to go off by myself. I need a little quiet time. I need to use the facilities. I don't know what he said. But they were far enough away from him that they did not hear a young, roaring lion. Now, don't think in your mind like Simba, like cute little lion. Like this was referring to a lion that was entering his prime in the pride. And when a lion is roaring, that means it has been watching you and it's been staking you out and it's coming at you and it's not going to lose. Although it did here. And I think that if every vineyard in Timnah had beware of lion signs, they would not have any sort of crime problem at all. Beware of dog signs are effective enough in our culture. So his parents obviously were not close enough to even hear the roar of a lion. So somehow he had taken a different path from them. Maybe, do you think just maybe, he wanted to sample some of the vineyards? You think maybe, just maybe, he knew his mom and dad knew about this vow, and so he needed to go his own pathway to go grab something before he was to meet his future bride. I think it's interesting, as he was ready to maybe break his vow, a lion comes charging at him to stop him? I don't know. It's a good question, but he tore it to pieces. And verse 7 says, then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. In other words, he liked her. I mean, he had to be brimming with some extra confidence, though, wouldn't you think? I mean, some guys do push-ups before their first date, you know, to kind of get things. I don't know what girls do, but I know what we as guys do. We want a little extra confidence, you know, maybe listen to a song that gets us pumped up in the car, whatever. He tears apart wild beasts and then goes down and says, hi, I'm Samson, and I am a rough and tumble fellow. But he liked her. He really did. And so they're setting up this wedding. So verse 8, after some days he returned to take her. And he turned aside as he walked back down to see the carcass of the lion he had destroyed. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. So for most of us, we would go running, screaming in the other direction as fast as we could. But for this man, it was an invitation. He scraped it out into his hands and went on eating as he went. Like this was some like a stand at the state fair or something. I mean, have you tried to take honey? I mean, beekeepers have very extensive outfits for a reason, I think. You know, they look like astronauts that don't understand the gravity situation or the pressure. They've got the nets and they've got all the big white and they're just reaching in and they use the little smoke to knock them out and take. He just reaches in with his bare hand and grabs it. How many times would he have been getting stung as he robbed them of their prize? And then he's just eating it as he walks. But where did he get the honey from? Where was it? Carcass of a dead lion. Another vow, broken. But his parents weren't around, as we find out. So he's breaking these vows like crazy. Verse 9, he scraped it into his hands and went on eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of a lion. I would think that would be one of those spit take moments if you found that out. Like, this is really good. Where'd you get it? Oh, inside a dead lion? I wouldn't be happy, and for a lot of different reasons, not just the broken vow. Verse 10, his father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there. For so the young men used to do. As soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, put your riddle that we may hear it. And he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. And in 3 days they could not solve the riddle. On the fourth day they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? So this isn't just like a gentleman's wager. I mean, this is serious business. And this was very common to have gambling or to have some sort of entertainment because it's a 7 day feast. There's got to be some kind of entertainment. And so Samson offers up this riddle that only he knows. The text even says his mom and dad don't even know where the honey came from or the whole story about the lion. So no one knows the answer. And you would think in this moment that his bride would be like, listen, my husband has bee stings on his hand because he wanted a snack. I'm not nervous about you guys coming after me. Oh, wouldn't you think that she would think he would protect her? But because she was a Philistine, and there are marriages that happen at this time that if the marriage would be so disruptive to the culture, like this would be, to have her come into the Israelite world, that they would stay, she would stay with her family, and he would just go visit her when he wanted to. And so she was going to stay with her mom and dad. She would be married to him, but her husband was living far away, and he would just come back when he wanted a little date night. And so that's the situation here. So she's thinking, if they say they're going to kill me and my family, he won't be here to protect me. So she starts to think through, how do I save my life and my family's life? And so she starts to work on him on this. Verse 16, and Samson's wife wept over him and said, you only hate me. You do not love me. You've put a riddle to my people and you've not told me what it is. And he said to her, behold, I have not told my father nor my mother. Shall I tell you? And she wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted. And on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him hard. She wore him down. Then she told the riddle to her people. And the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. Now, some people call husbands and wives like honey or baby or sweetie pie. He went with heifer here. Probably not the best move in that moment. I don't think he was very happy with her. But this was actually meant to be, it was a bit of a saying back then. Because the heifer was not a cow that they would use to do work then. It was their treasure. It was their prized possession. He's saying, she was my prized possession. And plowed with my heifer meant you abused her. You forced this out of her. If you had not abused my wife, you would never have known this answer. And so his anger raged so strongly, verse 19, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. And he went down to Ashkelon, over 20 miles away, I might add, and struck down 30 men of the town, took their spoil, and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. So these 30 guys are just sitting around sipping coffee, no idea what's going on, and they get rushed by an enraged Samson who beats them up, strips them naked, takes their clothes, drops them off, runs back home. And oh, by the way, for good measure, verse 20, and his wife was given to his best man. Does this feel like a little bit of antagonism going back and forth here? His wife is just handed over to his best man. Now, his best man had to be willing in this moment. So here's another moment where Samson's betrayed by someone that was, I mean, his best man. So maybe his best friend, you would have to assume. His best man took his wife. So his wife betrayed him. Now his best friend betrayed him. And he's got blood on his hands and he's angry. So here comes another incident. The second incident now with the Philistines. Verse 1 of chapter 15. After some days at the time of wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat. And he said, I will go in to my wife in the chamber. But her father would not allow him to go in. And her father said, I really thought that you utterly hated her. So I gave her to your best man, your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please take her instead. So as you can see here, this was exactly the marital relationship. The arrangement was that he would come when it was time to visit her. The problem is, he showed up with a young goat, which was the exact payment that you would bring to a prostitute to pay her. So there was an insult tucked into this. He's like, oh, I'm here to see my wife. Here's the payment. Whew. So dad maybe wasn't just super thrilled to see Samson back there. So maybe he enjoyed telling him that he couldn't go in. Take this other sister. But Samson said to them, this time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. So Samson went and caught 300 foxes. I don't know how long this would have taken. I know they say like sly as a fox. I'm assuming that means they're kind of tough to pin down. Any fox trappers here? Anybody? Have you ever trapped any? Okay, you're nodding. Why don't you raise your hand? You had your moment. There we go. Are they tough to catch? Okay, how long would it take you, Dave Gray, hunter extraordinaire, to catch 300 alive?
Ever.
So just start now, and then come back. We'll have the illustration. 300, he went out and just got them. He just found them. And it wasn't enough that he had 300 upset and angry foxes. But he ties their tails together and then lights their tails on fire. And it's during the wheat harvest season, which means everything is dry. And so he throws them into the field on fire, angry foxes with tails on fire. It sounds like a horror movie or something. I don't know what that is. But they just run through and they burn all of the wheat fields. They burn the stacks of wheat. They burn the stuff that was already harvested, ready to go. They even run into the prized vineyards and burn all of that down. This has escalated from a local squabble about an angry groom into a national economic issue. Because when you're messing with a nation's food supply, this just escalated. Then the Philistines said, who has done this? Verse 6. And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire anyway. So they're dead. Now Samson says, verse 7, if this is what you do, I swear I'll be avenged on you, and after that, I'll quit. You notice how he's kind of saying, like, listen, I owe you one more, but then let's stop this. Like, I'll be done. If you let me just do this, then we'll be finished, but that's not enough. And he struck them hip and thigh with a great blow. That, for those of you with bad hips, that just, it doesn't mean there was a special attack on the hips, it just means it was a very intense defeat. Very damaging, with a great blow, and he went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock of Etam. Verse 9, then the Philistines came up and encamped in Judah and made a raid on Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? They said, we have come up to bind Samson, the Philistines said, to do to him as he did to us. So then the 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines are ruling over us? Then what then is this that you have done to us? He said to them, as they did to me, so I have done to them. Do you catch right here? Do you sense that they're like, hey, there's 3,000 of us. You're pretty much the biggest, baddest thing in this whole area. Why don't you lead us and let's overthrow these clowns? No, that's not what they say, is it? It's like, what are you doing? They're ruling over us. You want to start a war? Which for some reason never occurred to anyone in the story. Like, yes, we should just start a war. And what he says, as they did to me, so I've done to them. It's always about personal revenge with Samson. Always about personal wrong. And they said, well, we have come down to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines. And Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not attack me yourselves. And they said, no, we'll only bind you and give you into their hands. We will surely not kill you. So they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. Verse 14, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting to meet him. Now, when it says they came shouting to meet him, this word for shouting in the Hebrew refers to the war chant, or the chant and the yelling and the singing of what the Israelites would do to worship God. It's used mostly in the Psalms and worship passages. So as they're coming up to take the Israelites' champion, they're mocking the Israelites as they come. They're singing their songs. It'd be like singing the national anthem or something like that. You know, the American national, as they're coming to take our president or something like that. Just mockery and just digging. He was ready to just hand himself over. But they're mocking them again. So then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the ropes around his arms became as flax that has caught fire, and his bonds, so he was even in bonds, melted off his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Now here's one moment where, depending on your translation, we'd have to edit this message after we post this. But this is the fresh jawbone of a donkey. And he put out his hand and he took it. And so there are those who believe it was fresh because he tore it off the face of a donkey that was standing there. Like it was really fresh. Like he just made it happen. And with it, he struck 1,000 men. And then he sang a song. With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, have I struck down 1,000 peeps. No, that would be if he was into rhyming. It just says men there. As soon as he finished speaking, he threw away the jawbone out of his hand, and that place was called Ramath-Lehi. And he was very thirsty. Verse 18, and he called upon the Lord and said, "You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant. And shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" You notice when he calls upon God for help? Only when he thinks he's going to die. He didn't call upon God to help him with all these vengeance stories. But when he thinks he's so thirsty, he literally says, "I am dying of thirst." Then he says, "God, help me. Will you please help me? Did you not just let all this happen to let me die of thirst in the desert?" And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came out from it. And when he drank, his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore, the name of it was called En-Hakkor. It is at Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Now we get to Samson and Delilah. So for 20 years, we don't really hear much about Samson, although his legend was very much alive and well. When it says he judged them for 20 years, most scholars don't think he actively was a judge over them. He was just sort of their leader, their champion for 20 years. So here goes Samson and Delilah. Samson went to Gaza, and Gaza was one of the five chief cities of the Philistines. So he's back in Philistia. And there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. The Gazites were told, "Samson has come here." And they surrounded the place and set an ambush for him all night at the gate of the city. They kept quiet all night, saying, "Let us wait till the light of the morning, then we'll kill him." But Samson lay till midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron. Another subtle showing of his strength. Just yanks the gates up and throws them on top of a mountain and then goes home. And then here's his undoing, verse 4. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek. You wonder what Samson, like what love was like to Samson. That word for love, boy, I did some research on it. It's like it could be anything from like affection to like deep unconditional love. I'm pretty sure it wasn't that for him. Somewhere in the lust category for him, as he's proven, he's a man driven by his desires. So strong physically and so weak mentally. So weak with his willpower, so weak, gives in to his flesh. Verse 4, after this he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Seduce him and see where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him that we may bind him to humble him. And we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." When it says the lords of the Philistines, there were the five chief cities. So there was five lords that came and offered her 1,100 shekels of silver each, which was 5,500 pieces. Each shekel of silver represented 4 days' wages for a laborer. So if my math is flowing quickly and correctly here, it is 22,000 days of a day laborer. And if you figure that the average U.S. American's income for someone who is a laborer, someone who works with their hands, is somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000. That's about $500 per week divided by 5 days, about $100 a day. So 22,000 times 100 is how much money? You just need to know the last part. Anybody? 2.2 million U.S. dollars. Delilah. Oh, I will take that bribe. Thank you very much. Now, most scholars, the lowest I saw was 89,000, and then up to this 2 million, somewhere in the 700 to 2 million, depending on when it was written, because, you know, obviously things change currency-wise. So she's offered a lot of money. I wanted you to not lose the fact that this was not like Judas' 30 pieces of silver. This was a huge sum. So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies and how you might be bound, that one could subdue you." Samson said to her, "If they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." Then the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. Now she had men lying in ambush in an inner chamber. And she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Now, each of these incidents, I always, as a kid, for some reason, pictured that when she said the Philistines are upon you, that they were actually upon him. But if you read carefully, they're not. They're waiting to see if he's really subdued. There's a rare moment where the soldiers were kind of smart for the first time, like in Old Testament history. I have an idea, guys. Instead of just running out and getting wiped out, let's just see if the ropes work, and then we'll move in. So, they were in wait. And so, it also makes sense why Samson kind of kept up the ruse, right? Because I was like, okay, this guy is the dumbest man in the world. If every time he tells her how to do it, she's got soldiers jumping out of her couch cushions to attack him, you would think he would stop. But he wasn't aware that they were in there. They were just hiding. Exactly. Verse 10, "Then Delilah said to Samson, 'Behold, you have mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound.' And he said to her, 'If they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man.' So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' And the men lying in ambush were in an inner chamber. But he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. Then Delilah said to Samson, 'Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound.' And he said to her, 'If you weave the 7 locks of my head with the web and fasten it tight with the pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man with a really bad hairdo.'" Oh, I'm sorry, that wasn't in there. "So while he slept, Delilah took the 7 locks of his head and wove them into the web, and she made them tight with the pin and said to him, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.'" It's funny how he's getting closer to the truth, though. You notice that? He's got her up in this region here now. "But he woke from his sleep and pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web. And she said to him, 'How can you say, I love you, when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies.' And when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death." So dramatic was our hero. Okay, anti-hero. "And when she pressed him, and he told her all his heart and said to her, 'A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man.'" You notice what he just said there? He says that my strength is in my hair. He believed that his strength was in his hair. So far gone was Samson at this point that he really believed. Because think about it, all the other vows didn't matter. So he took a couple grapes and just fended off a lion. He's like, "Hey, I'm still strong." He threw his hand into the bee's nest and took some honey. Still strong. But this was the last thing. He really believed that he could not cut his hair or all of his strength would be gone. Verse 18, "When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, 'Come up again, for he has told me all his heart.' Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands." Verse 19, it was like 140 pounds of silver in actual weight. A lot of money. "She made him sleep on her knees, and she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, 'The Philistines are upon you, Samson.' And he awoke from his sleep and said, 'I will go out as at other times and shake myself free.' But he did not know that the Lord had left him. And the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes. and brought him down to Gaza, verse 21, and bound him with bronze shackles. And he ground at the mill in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. It's amazing. He got up and thought, my strength. He didn't realize, you know, his strength was gone, but it's saying in the text here, he didn't know that God had left him. And he still had not connected that God was all the source of his strength. They gouged out his eyes. It's interesting because Samson, the name Samson means the sun, S-U-N. You're the sun. And you know, the sun brings life, but if you get too close to the sun, what happens? If you stay out in the sun too long on your lawnmower without proper sunscreen, what happens? Yeah, sun can be a dangerous thing. So they're like, okay, you're the sun. How about two permanent solar eclipses for you? You're going to see nothing but darkness. It's interesting because anyone who got really close to Samson got burned, got abused, got hurt. And then they had him work at the mill, ground at the mill in the prison. Now, what's unique about this was that this mill that they would use to grind things up was normally run by donkeys. Donkey was the animal that would do this. So they literally hitched him up to grind up the wheat or whatever it was that he was grinding up in a circle, maybe even sharing the duties with a donkey. They did not appreciate those legends. They did not appreciate his exploits. They did not appreciate that he killed 1,000 of their countrymen with the jawbone of a donkey. So now you can act like one and be one to us. The final act of Samson's life. Here we go, verse 23. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand. And when the people saw him, they praised their God. For they said, our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country who has killed many of us. Verse 25, and when their hearts were merry, they said, call Samson that he may entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison and he entertained them. Also that word for entertainment means danced for them. So they made a blind, broken down, abused, filthy slave dance. And this made them really happy. They made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them. Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. And on the roof there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me. Now he's addressing God in the highest possible way, saying Adonai Yahweh. Like, I mean, there's no higher way to address God. Please remember me and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes. Isn't it amazing that even at the end he still doesn't get it? He still wants his own revenge. What does God say all the time to his people? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Yet Samson's still saying, I owe them this just one more time. Give me strength one more time. I know it's from you now. My hair's growing back. I get it. It's from you. But let me get my vengeance on them. Still not understanding that this was they were worshiping an idol. A stage was set for God to do something only God can do. In a sense, everything else was misdirection setting up this one final act, where he would use the blind, defeated, weak, former champion to do something that no one could have ever thought to do. And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he had ever killed during his life. God did more through Samson in his weakness, in his blindness, in his state of utter desperation than when he was the strongest man the world had ever seen. He did more in his death, it says very clearly, than he ever did in his life. This plays out so perfectly as one of God's stories, doesn't it? The strength of man failing, and then God's strength in a moment where no one else could possibly take credit. A blind slave could not take credit for this moment. This was God himself allowing a mighty blow to be struck to the Philistines. That wedge, when he said, I will use him to begin the deliverance of Israel, that begin is that wedge. This collapsing of the house was the start of the deliverance that David would later carry out when he faced the Philistines, Samson, by the name of Goliath. It's amazing though, because in his final act, he had hatred coursing through his veins. He so hated the Philistines, he so hated their gods, he so hated how much he had been humiliated, that he says, God, give me strength one more time to kill all of them. Let me die with them. And yet if you look at this story, he wanted to die with his enemies. But if I think about this and I think about someone else, I think about Jesus Christ in this moment. I think when Jesus was arrested, after we did the communion here in the story, he goes to the garden, he's praying, he knows what's coming, he's betrayed, he's arrested, he's beaten, he's humiliated, he's mocked, his beard is plucked, his head has got a crown of thorns thrust into it. They make him wear a purple robe to mock the fact that he's the King of Kings to them. And then they parade him through the city, half naked and half dead, forcing him to carry his own cross. Later it said in Scripture that they made a spectacle of him. They tried to make a spectacle of him, because that was the point. Crucifixion was meant to scare off anyone, to say, no one is bigger than Rome. No one. We will embarrass, humiliate you, and stop these rebellions. And yet when Jesus hung there on the cross, Samson died with his enemies. Jesus said, I want to die for my enemies. And his final act was giving his life for those who killed him. Was giving his life for those who had persecuted him. Giving his life for those who had mocked him and tried to betray him. All of that. He wanted his life to end for those who were around him. And the emotion that was pumping through his veins at that moment was not hatred. It was love. He was so full of love in the moment when he had every right to hate, that he died for the Philistines. He died for the Romans. He died for those who put him on the cross. And that is the kind of Savior that we serve. You want to talk about Samson starting the deliverance and David finishing it from the Philistines? The true deliverance was earned for us on the cross when Jesus Christ died for us. I pray that today that would encourage your heart. I pray as you go forward this week that what would rush through your veins is love for the world that Jesus died for. And we'd also see that everything in this Bible points to Jesus. It's all about him, isn't it? All of it. We are out of time. So let's pray together, and then you guys will be dismissed. Why don't you stand with me as we pray? Jesus, when I look at a story like this, I'm so humbled by your love. I'm so humbled by your sacrifice, by your commitment, by your faithfulness to what you have been given to do. That we may be tempted to die for friends or for family, but you laid down your life for enemies. You laid down your life for Romans. You laid down your life for us. Forever breaking our bonds of sin. Because we were just like Samson. We were blind. We were slaves. And we were only concerned with our own end. And yet you have set us free by the power of your death, burial, and resurrection. You've opened our eyes and given us our sight back. You have set us free from slavery. We are now free to live for you. And now we can live for something bigger than ourselves. We can live for your kingdom to come. We can live to see others get their sight, get their freedom, and get a cause worth living for and even worth dying for. So God, I lay this church at your feet. I say, have your way in us, God. We want to live lives worthy of you. We want to live lives of adventure for you. We want to live by grace, forgiven and free, to spread the word, to spread the story, the greatest story ever told, that you came, you lived, you died, you rose, and now you're coming again, and we have been set free. So God, I pray now that we would live this way, and that you would continue to do what it takes to strip away our perceived strength so that our greatest impact in this world would continue to be in moments where we are weak and you are strong. And that's a big, scary prayer request, God, but we have all seen it, and we want you to take these lives if you want to. We are not our own. We've been bought with a price. Therefore, we offer back to you what you've given to us. May it be so, God. It's in Jesus' precious, powerful, and loving name we ask it. Amen.